The three questions that are going to be the main focus of today is the first one is going to be a discussion about what is the divine plan for the human race. I know this is a bold claim and it can't be answered. I know, how are you going to answer that? That would take a whole, weeks upon weeks. But what is the divine plan for the human race in light of the resurrection? The second one, who is the Messiah and what does a Messiah do? That's something that's very important because we're going to see that the people in the first century did not have an expectation of, crucified by pagans. All right. So what is the divine plan for the human race? Who is the Messiah? And the follow-up is, what does a Messiah do? And then lastly, in what way is Jesus' resurrection instrumental in securing justification? In what way is Jesus' resurrection instrumental in securing justification? So again, one more time, very quickly. What is the divine plan for the human race? The second, what is a Messiah and what does a Messiah do? And lastly, in what way is Jesus' resurrection instrumental in securing justification? So these are theory-laden terms, but we're gonna do our best to unpack them. So I'm going to start with a story, and it actually happened when the Dorn shortly came to this church. It's only natural that I forget who it was. It might have been TJ or somebody else was speaking with Nate, found out he was a professor. And as is the case generally, if you find someone as a professor, you find someone who might also be a professor. And we have three of them in this church. And so I don't know if he pointed you, Nate, to you. I'm sure he did. And then eventually he made his way to me. So nothing entirely unlike last week at the picnic. I was speaking with someone who's basically a house manager of someone in Miami, and my natural thought was Bill Sturman, because he works on yachts. So I was like, you have to talk to Bill. You could share stories. So at any rate, the Dorns were introduced to us, and then I started talking with him, found out he's a professor of biology. And again, I'm a professor of philosophy. I see some new faces. So we decided shortly after to take a trip to the Everglades. And I will recommend this. I'd never been up until that point. And sadly, never been since. And not because the experience was awful, but I will say this. If you go to the Everglades with a biologist, everything else is like secondary or tertiary to that experience. I mean, he can point out things that you're not, so it was just a good experience. But he and I were seeing all these things and reading all the little inscriptions at the various parts. And we just spoke to each other. We barely knew each other at this point. It was a mutual sort of understanding that look at what's going on. And what's really going on, and he and I were discussing this, is that here are people that are essentially worshiping the creation. Not worshiping the creator, worshiping the creation. I mean, it's great to be conservationally minded. It's great to be, to recycle. I'm all on board with recycling. But you have to ask, what is it really that we're called to do, and what is it that's been done wrong here? And that gets me to the idea of this what actually happened and what was our original intent. So it is clear that with the fall of Adam, it did more than just introduce sin and death. Right? It also usurped our role over creation. Right? So one of the things we have to get clear about what a Messiah is eventually going to do, we have to see the problem. And the problem is we were supposed to be God's wise agents over creation. And we through sin, through the fall, through Adam, we basically usurped that role. And yet, on the other hand, we still have the marker of that. We still have this desire to want to care for the creation, to steward over it. And that's why it's very fascinating when people say, well, why do you care if this species goes extinct? If it's just all about evolution and the natural order of things, why are you so concerned about the Delta smelt in California, so to such an extent where they're diverting water that they desperately need to try to preserve the species. So one of the things is we're not called to worship the creation. We're called to worship the creator. And this power has gone unfulfilled ever since the fall. And so what are we going to see ultimately as we move towards the resurrection? And that's what the subject of class is going to be. Is that it's not just the return from the exile of sin and death, which it represents, and we've been speaking about that over the last couple weeks. It's also the restoration of humankind in the sense that we are going to be back in the place that we were supposed to be. And that's something very important when we're thinking about situating this context, that this was a, for Paul in particular, it's a reaffirmation of that original divine plan. And the divine plan was this life-giving event, right, that was known before the foundation of the world, which is very fascinating. So before there ever was the fall, there was this understanding that this was going to be the plan. As I'm going to speak to later, this was not a plan B. The crucifixion was not a plan B. The resurrection was not a plan B. It was the saving act of God from the foundations. And so this is very important to situate even at the beginning. But it's really primarily about ushering the age to come in the present age. So I'm going to focus today primarily on Paul. I'm not going to be able to go through all the Pauline writings, but we're going to focus on some of them and passages in particular. I didn't print them out for you, unfortunately. I can reference them to you. But in particular, we're going to be looking at the various moments in Paul's writings and his emphasis, particularly in Colossians, Philippians, and primarily Romans, at least the first few books, because that's where we get this idea of messiahship. Romans really is the central theme is messiahship of Jesus. So we're going to see how that works and what the context is. All right, so last week at the end, and this is I'm only going to reference the Dorns twice. I did one with Nate, and now I'm going to, because Megan at the end of last class asked a question about Lazarus. All right, and so one of the things that I said in reference to that was Lazarus and Jairus' daughter, of course, they were brought back from the dead, but of course we know what ultimately happens to them again. All right, so what eventually happened to both of those individuals? They died. So it's not as if they were brought back and they never tasted death again. They weren't joined to a incorruptible body or a glorified body. And so I want to just pick up that theme very briefly just to continue the thought. Jesus was not just resuscitated. It wasn't just that he came back in the same form that he was before. He is represented in the glorified body. That is the promise of what's ours to be. Right? So it's that transformed body, which is very important. So his body is no longer going to taste death, right? And what's the promise that we have in the hope of the bodily resurrection? That we'll be joined to bodies that are incorruptible, that no longer taste death. That the final final statement will be made about the fall, all right? And it's not just merely, it's a fulfillment, right? Not an abandonment. It's not the case that it's made unnecessary or insignificant, far from it. It's the idea that these things are now fulfilled. And so one of the things that I find very fascinating is when we talk about who is the Messiah and what's a Messiah to do, it's very important to realize that no one expected that Jesus would die, that the Messiah would die, especially at the hands of pagans. Right, this was not part of people's understanding. And I mentioned last week that the Pharisees very much believed in the resurrection. I pointed out, for instance, the Sadducees did not. They were like the aristocracy. But for the Pharisees, they longingly looked for the restoration of Israel. And part of that restoration was not someone who would die by the hands of the enemy, but someone who's going to restore Israel to its natural state, as far as they saw, seeing it as the fulfillment of the commandment, the covenant that was started in Genesis 15. And then you look at Romans, one of the things that's fascinating is Romans 4, where a lot of us like to go to, about what that Abrahamic covenant really means and the fulfillment of it. It's really a re-understanding, if you will, re-description of what was going on in Genesis 15. And it's about fulfillment. So for those that don't know, the Genesis 15 passage is the passage where God makes a covenant with Abraham. And you know one of the effects of that covenant is that your descendants will outnumber the stars, right? So this idea and that this is the beginning, and this is where I'm going to make things new. Well, Paul is going to that, and what he sees is in the aftermath of the resurrection is the doing away of the distinctions that made sense everywhere else. And distinctions make a lot of sense to us. We very much still live in a class-based society in one way or another. And what Christ was, through Paul, was saying is that basically all these distinctions really have no meaning anymore. Whether you're circumcised or uncircumcised, that's irrelevant. So this is the idea of fulfillment. And so the Messiah is someone who came to die And it's the resurrection, the death and resurrection, is in essence God's way of doing what he said he would do. And part of what he said he would do was that he would fulfill both ends of the covenant. Of course, this wasn't fully understood. It's not fully understood to many even today. I would argue in all of us there's a spot that's still blinded to what the true mystery of this is. But I want to just illustrate again this concept that no one anticipated that the Messiah was going to die at the hands of pagans. All right, again, they would have called that a sham. So in the coming weeks, Lord willing, we're going to be talking about the facts surrounding the resurrection, like the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances. All right, so we're going to actually get into the what happened at Easter, essentially, that's coming, starting even next week. But the idea is, many people like to think that the early Christians were a bunch of boobs. I realize a bunch of gullible people. I would say like gullible, willing to believe anything. I'm going to make the case hopefully by next week that that's not the case. But suffice it to say here, they would have recognized that as a sham the same way people today would recognize it as a sham. All right, they understood that the dead stay dead. This wasn't something that's just a 21st century invention or Enlightenment invention. This is something that was well understood by people. And no one had the expectation, even though they anticipated resurrection and primarily saw that as the hope for Israel and the restoration of it, the future state, no one anticipated the means by which this was going to be accomplished. All right, and that's what's sort of fascinating. And you see this transition in Paul's thinking. It's not just the conversion experience, but it's also how resurrection becomes a dominant theme in all of his writings. Even when he's talking about other things, he still has resurrection in mind. All right, so in Philippians 3, when he talks about, I count everything as loss, all right, and all the things that I've done, I count them as rubbish. Well, what is he really doing? He's comparing that with what's been done for him. And if there's no resurrection, as he reminds us in 1 Corinthians 15, then we're still dead in our sins and our faith has been futile. So the idea is, this is the cornerstone of everything, and everybody missed it. That's really fascinating, and there's ways in which we miss it today in our present suffering. So one of the things I want to talk about, what a Messiah does, is even the language that Paul uses is meant to help us in the here and now, right? As members of the kingdom that's yet to be, but also present in the everyday life. And so there's a connection that's being made here that Paul is deliberately making across all of his writings. What does it mean then about the dead staying dead and looking at the Romans? So Caesar is often a parody for Paul. All right, he's often pointing out the power of Caesar. And I can't, you can imagine Rome and its power at the height of its glory. Right, this is not the time of the Visigoths coming and they see the end. Right? Although they didn't see that, but that's like the turning point. But that's centuries to come. This is the height of Roman power. And whatever else is true, what would you expect? You're not going to be able to defeat this power without something more powerful than that power. And there was nothing on the horizon. So the understanding basically was the Roman emperors were really the most powerful people on earth. And yet even these emperors never once claimed that they were raised from the dead or that anyone else like them were raised from the dead. So this understanding that maybe this is part of, powerful mythology, that somehow we're more powerful than you and I'm going to raise myself from the dead. No. They declared themselves to be gods, desired to be worshipped as such, but they never included in that belief resurrection. All right, so what sets Jesus' claims apart and why this makes it so significant, particularly determining what a Messiah is and what a Messiah does? It's not enough just to look at the teachings of Jesus and the sayings of Jesus and think that's sufficient. And it's also not enough to just look at the resurrection and say that's sufficient. Because, for instance, to remind us, Lazarus, Jairus' daughter, brought back to life, but no one claimed they were the Messiah. Of course, it's the idea that taken together, these sets of beliefs become both necessary and sufficient. So I wanted to speak briefly about that. I know I'm throwing terms out there. Hopefully it's not too obscure. But the idea basically is there's many people that say, hey, I can tolerate Jesus' teachings, particularly about certain areas of life, like the poor. So Catholics, a lot of Catholics, I only say because I teach at a Catholic institution, so I'm not, so I'm familiar with how they view this. The preferential option for the widow, the poor, the orphan is really motivating a lot of what they do in terms of effective works. And a lot of us can read the teachings of Jesus and find something that resonates with us. Even if you're not a believer, you can find something that resonates with you. I like his willingness to speak to power. I like his willingness to comfort the poor, to hang around those that are deemed the most unworthy. But if you don't couple that with the resurrection, then you fail to understand what he really was and what he really is and what's represented by his coming to earth. So it's not just he's coming and we like his teachings and it's not just his resurrection, but when you take both together, then you get this idea that each of these are necessary conditions, but then taken together, they become sufficient. And the power of the resurrection is in the absence of the resurrection, and all those teachings are powerless. You can't just claim these passages and expect to have your life transformed. All right. Part of the idea is the resurrection represents the power of transformation in the here and now as well. So it enables us to look longingly with hope about what's to come because what's been done. And part of the thing that I want to really focus on heavily is that Paul understood this. So that's why he could say something like, in these present sufferings, right, I count all but loss. He's not indifferent to the plights that you and I go through, that he was going through, but he understood that the resurrection was more than just merely a down payment. It was the fulfillment. So when you say something like, oh, death, where is thy victory? Oh, death, where is thy sting? It's not just some, passing, let's laugh at death or mock at death. It's the idea that death has been fulfilled. And in essence, that can be a form of mocking death. But the reason it's no longer has the power is because what's been done on our behalf, for us, the thing that we could not do for ourselves. So part of the present Christian experience, I want to submit to you, is this resurrection as power. And Christians should live in the present as members already of the age to come that is not yet. All right, so a lot of people around here say that and speak this way, and it's fantastic. I've been declared righteous, and I'm slowly becoming the person that I've been declared to be. And part of this idea of the resurrection is that we are righteous because we've been declared righteous because we're identified in the Messiah, right? And what that can do is it can free us up in the here and now, right, to become resurrection people. And so one of the things I want to submit to us today is that we are resurrection people. We're looking longingly, not just for the restoration of here, but the merging of heaven and earth, a new heaven and a new earth, where there is no sin, there's no death, there's no identity theft, there's no cancers, there's no diagnosis of these things. But it's not enough to go the way that a lot of people, I think, misunderstand this. And one of the things they see is, I just want these sufferings to end and taken up into the ether where I can have, disembodied bliss. That's not what Christianity is about. It's not a disembodied bliss. It's not, although this can be fun in movies and sometimes entertaining about being snatched away and joined up in the air, it's not about snatching anything away or snatching anyone away. It's about restoring the original plan. And the original plan is that heaven and earth will be made new again because of what was done in the past. And so it's longingly looking to the transforming of the bodies themselves as well. It's not just that Platonic view of the disembodied soul that I spent some time going over. It's not just this idea that the mind is really your essence, your soul, is your essence that way, and the body is the prison. This is a Greek invention. This is not the Bible. And so part of the understanding is that we are going to, in the past, present, and future, see the effective power of what the resurrection represents in our lives. All right. So looking at this through the lens, and what should we deem? It is true that we're going to suffer. Paul was very much aware of this. He speaks at length about it. He doesn't skirt around it. In fact, he welcomes it, but it's not the idea that he's doing it in a way that suggests that it's not real pain and it's not real suffering. Paul himself was moved by the trials that he experienced, and what the recommendation for all of us is to continue to look longingly into what's to come and what the restoration is going to look like. And I can't emphasize enough as we move in to what I'm going to consider the meat of this class, when we actually look at the resurrection itself, we're just doing the foundational work here, is that there was no anticipation that this is what a Messiah is or what a Messiah does. And yet, after the resurrection, there was no like messiahship line that was created. Right? So when a king dies, there's always what? A king that comes in its place. There was no successor line of messiahship. It wasn't that James, who had probably been the natural one to come next, became, you know, the next Messiah. This was a concept that's unique to Jesus and the person of Jesus. But part of the idea is, if we see this through the original lens of the divine plan for human race, for the human race, which means what? Restoring all that was made wrong through the fall. Right? In the second Adam, Jesus himself fulfilling what was left unfulfilled. But it's not an abandonment. And Paul, that's why Paul can say in Philippians 3 that I count all this as loss, because he's realizing that this, what we do in the here and now, is really not the essence. It's really not the significant matter. Not to say that it's insignificant, but the idea basically is it's not going to make you righteous. What does that is Christ's saving work on your behalf. So seeing this as the plan A and not the plan B is very important. This wasn't a default. Oh, they messed up, so now I got to fix it. It's the idea that God, through the resurrection, right, Jesus is fulfilling that which was demanded. And so fulfilling both ends of the covenantal language and the covenantal promise. So we constantly see phrases in Paul's writings. Walk in the Spirit, inherit the kingdom of God. These were all largely probably understood by the people he's writing to and the audience he's writing to as anticipation of the future resurrection, right? So not just living in the ether, not just hanging out as disembodied spirits. So one of the things that I would like to do is just anticipate, you know, because I realize we spend a lot of time looking at the basic concepts and the foundation, and sometimes that can be very, you know, perhaps even to some uninteresting, but can lose focus. But what I want to suggest is, if we don't do that first, and the reason I spent some time doing that, before just diving into the actual historical facts surrounding Jesus, what's likely to happen is that we're going to fail to truly appreciate the significance of the event. All right, we might see the sign, but fail to recognize the significance behind the sign. The first class, I spent some time talking about the history and how history works. And what we see with Christ is that there's no one that doubts, even historians don't doubt this, even secular historians don't doubt this, that there was a man named Jesus of Nazareth who lived when around the time period that people are attributing to him, and that he died and died a death on a cross. So no one really disputes that, and he has to be dead, because you can't be raised if you were not first dead. All right? Otherwise, it just looks like you were dead, you're just playing dead, someone just disappeared. No, you actually have to be dead. So that's the first important fact surrounding the historical person of which we're talking about today, and the significance of that going forward. The second fact that's really important is that the tomb is found empty. Now, by themselves, death and empty tomb, it doesn't necessarily confer resurrection. Right, what might be some alternative explanations for what occurred? If somebody died and you don't find the body. Just some thoughts. Yeah. Someone stole it. Right? And there are grave robbers, right? They often don't take bodies and bones, but they take belongings. And we talked about that in the first week as well, that when people were dead, and this is true today even in our culture, in many cultures. I realize saying our culture is kind of difficult to say because we represent many different backgrounds, but I could just speak to my experience. It's not uncommon when people die in my family that they're buried with their treasures. It could be Jets outfits and Jet footballs signed by Joe Namath. It could be whatever else you think you need for the afterlife. But this idea of having these belongings with you in that culture, it was, you got to pay the price for admission, right? So funeral rites and rituals. So everyone agrees that he was dead, that the tomb was, you know, found empty. They don't necessarily agree on the fact that resurrection occurred. But the interesting thing is what comes next. Right? So the third fact that's often discussed, and I've been highlighting this, at least anticipating the highlight of it, is that he started to appear to people. And in some cases, the appearances were not directly recognized, which would make sense if it wasn't just a mere recitation. All right, so he still bears the marks. That's why he invites Thomas to touch. And what I said last week, and as a reminder for those that were here, maybe an introduction for those that weren't, Thomas insists on a certain kind of epistemology. And the epistemology insists on is that I have to actually touch. Right? And then upon seeing Jesus, he reverts to a weaker epistemology, a weaker way of knowing. Seeing is enough. But Jesus points to a third way. You thought it was about touching. Then you just settled for seeing. And I'm telling you, it's just about believing. Right? And that's really the way in which we're called to enter into this, through faith. Right? So part of the explanation here is he's appearing to people, including some that did not have prior belief in him. Right? And they all were testifying to what they were witnessing. And then the last fact that's often discussed when people look at these facts surrounding the resurrection is that the disciples came to have a profound shift in their belief. I've spoken about this before in a different class, but it's really important and it's worth emphasizing, particularly about where we're ultimately going to go here. I don't know about you, but if you spent an inordinate amount of time living with someone that you really thought was going to, restore power, the A-team. And again, the disciples themselves didn't fully understand the messiahship of Jesus, right? We've heard sermons recently and in the past that have emphasized this. I've spoken about it in different classes. For all their understanding, they saw but didn't see. So they expected that he was going to do restoration here. Even the disciples didn't understand that it meant death. Martha got it. When she's sitting and saying, "Did you hear what he's saying? He's going to die," and breaks out the perfume. But the rest didn't see it. So if you're that close to Jesus and you don't see it, and he's talking about it incessantly, it's reasonable to think that they had no anticipation of what this really was going to be, this event. But here it occurs, he's dead. And I don't know about you, but it's reasonable to think that the very next thought that you might have in this instance, aside from what do I do now, is what are they going to do to us now? It's not uncommon that you're just going to take out the top and leave the secondary and tertiary people to come in its wake. So they're afraid, they're concerned, they're thinking, what do we do now? We'll go back to fishing? I don't know, what are we going to do? And in a short order of time, everything changes for them. They go from cowering to zealots. Right? Even Paul, who's not part of the original apostles at this point, right? He goes from zealotry in a way of trying to pursue Christians to kill them to having a conversion experience. And it wasn't just that he heard a voice and that's enough. That was the beginning. But what really does it for Paul, if I can submit this to you, is he saw the hope that we're speaking about, that the resurrection and its power is in the here and now, that all that was promised to Abraham in Genesis is now fulfilled. And that's why he saw in a way that maybe some others didn't see. And why he can call out Peter at a picnic and say, hey, you're not walking in line with the gospel because you're still acting as if these divisions matter. And if you get the resurrection, what's one thing you can't walk away with if you truly understand the power in the resurrection? That there are divisions, that there are circumcised and uncircumcised. So looking at the disciples themselves and their beliefs, there's really only two explanations that come to mind about explaining what might have occurred here. And we're going to dive far more deeply into this next week. One is that they were just really gullible people. And I've been speaking, setting the foundation as to why that's probably not reasonable to think. That, they just thought all kinds of myths. And hopefully some of that has sunk in. But I can suggest it this way. Gullible basically means someone is easily deceived. And we know that oftentimes human beings can be easily deceived. You think of cults. So what if somebody says, man, Christianity is just like every other religion. It preys on the vulnerable. It preys on people who need something to get through life. And I'm not one of those people that need something to get through life. I'm going to do it by myself. And look, they're just sort of weak-minded people. And unfortunately, we do know that some cults prey on people. What I find interesting, though, is when you look at some of the people who become cult members, they're not always, quote-unquote, the weak-minded people, at least by secular standards. Many of them tend to be professionals, you know, people you wouldn't expect would get suckered into something like this. But what we do know is these things happen over time. It happens slowly. But one thing is clear. You have someone like Thomas insisting on evidence. You have someone like Paul who has the equivalent of two PhDs. These are not typically the people that you would suggest are just merely gullible people willing to believe anything for any reason. And the insisting on evidence and the lack of avoidance of evidence. Now, did they miss it? Sure. And they repeatedly point that out, which is another fascinating thing about the scriptures. They don't shy away from their own bumbling nature of missing it, of failing to get it. They highlight it. He said it was just going to happen, and we didn't see it. All right, so you have this ongoing conversation where they're not presenting themselves in the best light. But it's not the case, and I've used the Amish as an example only because my wife's from Pennsylvania, and she's from York, and Lancaster County is a surrounding county, and there's a lot of Amish in that region. My best friend from college, sad to say, his ex-wife now, but his ex-wife's best friend was in an Amish community and went to college and came out. And there was a documentary done that maybe 20 years ago now, maybe 25 years ago, and she was actually in the documentary because she's someone that left the Amish community. But one of the fascinating things that I always found about the Amish is they deliberately set it up in such a way that people are not going to have the tools to adequately reflect on the situation. You take a 16-year-old and you give them lots of money, which is what they sell a lot of high-quality items. I mean, I still have a laundry rack that we use today that's like 25 years old, and it's still in shape, despite all the moves that we made. And they have an eighth-grade education, and they're sent out to experience the world. Now, I don't know about you, but if you had just an eighth-grade education, money, sudden freedom that you never had before, you're not going to make the most wisest decisions. Right, you're not going to reclaim that wise agent over God's creation and look to steward things. You're not going to look for a financial advisor to diversify your portfolio. You're actually going to probably do the things that a normal person would do, even at any age, but particularly at a young age. You're going to waste it on living. You're going to buy cars, video game systems, food, drugs, alcohol. I mean, all the things that you would think, then that's what happens. Now, after a time, what are you going to realize about your life living in the mud? One of the prodigal sons realize when he walked away and lived lavishly? What did he eventually realize? Yeah, this is not what I thought it was going to be. I thought this was going to mean freedom for me. Right? He saw servant as slave, and he saw this kind of life as liberty, so he lived it. And what did he ultimately realize? That's really not freedom. That's the slavery that nobody wants. And he has this thought that probably obviously God gave to him. What are you doing? You can go back. And so one of the things that when we look at this is they really understood, all right, that there was no plan B here. They were all in. And when you look at the Amish as an example, they realize this is not delivering, and so they figure, you know what, maybe I'll just, go back home. It was better there. And then, meanwhile, back at the ranch, the elders of the Amish are celebrating, because what does it look like? It looks like that this person came to this decision by himself or herself, when really the elders have orchestrated this very cleverly so that someone realizes all the futility of life and then runs to be re-embraced. And someone says, well, isn't that the story of the prodigal sons then? Isn't this the same thing that's occurring in the Bible? Well, no. It's not. Because it's not the issue of coercion or control or some backsided way of bringing in servitude. It's the understanding that the only way to truly have freedom over all of life's sufferings is to find yourself in the place that Paul found himself. And he talks about this in Colossians 3, to be hidden in Christ and eagerly looking forward to the resurrection that's to come, the bodily resurrection. So the idea is not just an escape clause, or I'm going to run to someone because they're going to provide protection for me from the big bad world. But it's the idea that all of this, without the proper mooring, It doesn't matter whether your health is restored or not if you're looking apart from Christ. It doesn't matter if there's no more identity thieves or not, because ultimately what's going to happen to all of us anyway? We're going to die. So even if you have a good life for this short time that we're on this planet, if there's nothing beyond this, then that should cause concern for us. It should cause more than just a sort of melancholic state. Right? And yet, most people don't see that or don't want to see that, but the disciples understood this. And so when you're looking at this idea of maybe they were gullible, maybe they were just charlatans. That's the other thing that people often say. Maybe they're just looking to make a name for themselves. They wanted the reputation. And yet, what do we know? What's true about charlatans? I've never really heard of a charlatan, I don't know if you have, that's died for the belief. They die for their belief. Anyone ever heard of a scam artist that sticks around long enough to die for the scam or go to prison for the scam? Some of them do, but it's because they get caught, not because they, you know, stick around and believe it so strongly. And so part of the thinking here as we look forward to what's to come in the coming weeks is that the resurrection represents part of God's divine plan for the human race. It wasn't a plan B, it's plan A, and it's restoring all things, right, including bringing the age to come and making the present age new creation, new heaven, new earth, where there is no corruption anymore, no death, no disease, no decay. So when Paul is trying to encourage us, what he's trying to encourage, if I can submit it this way, is to see resurrection's power in both the past, Genesis 15, he points to that in Romans 4, in the present, in the sufferings that you're going through on a day-to-day basis, and in the future, this idea of the hope that we strive for. And it's not striving for a hope that's, you know, we're all going to be like Pollyannish and just, you know, I'm a half-full kind of guy. It's not that. It's the hope of what we see through Christ himself. So it's not just believing, like, you know, people say, you know, I'm all into Legos. Anyone who knows me knows that. And there's the Lego movie. At the end of the first Lego movie, they have like a cat poster, and all it says is believe. And the idea is, and it's not just that. It's not just believe like in a cat poster. It's we see the evidence of God's Son coming down to us, of dying for us, fulfilling the covenant, being that first fruit of which many will follow, and we eagerly look for that. And that's the idea. That gives me hope. I don't know if it gives you hope. I hope it does. But the idea is that it's a fulfillment of all things being made new. So are we still going to go through sufferings? Of course. So one of the things that troubles me, I'm sure troubles many of you, if not all of you, is when people believe that if I become a Christian, all these things are going to go away. That's not the hope that we're given about in the intermediate state. And the escape plan is not really the escape plan either. That I'm just going to be snatched away from this and then I'll have no more troubles and I'll just live, you know, as a disembodied bliss. That's not it either. The thing that we look eagerly for is the resurrection, the bodily resurrection, the transformation of all that we are, and God restoring and making all things new. Right, reversing the curse, but fulfilling his promises. And that, to me, is just very encouraging. So when we start next week to look at more in depth about the evidence of the resurrection itself and more into this concept of Messiah and the hope of what it represents, hopefully this will start to string together. And I apologize for maybe not having the sheet and lack of connective thoughts, but I don't know if you ever had your identity stolen. Not fun. Not fun at all. That's true. It's my avatar. But I don't think he'd be here on a Sunday morning. And that's why I'm glad you are. Because what is true about this? This is not something that people really always want to do, and yet this is life-giving and life-sustaining. So if I can end on this note, one of the most difficult things, I think, for me at least, is reminding myself, and I have to remind myself on a daily basis about the resurrection power in both what's to come and in the here and now. And it's not just, you know, a mantra or the 30 ways of not having this bother you kind of thing. It's understanding that in all of our present sufferings, right, in all that we go through, we understand that there's a incorruptible body, glorified body, that's waiting upon the final moment. And none of us know when that is. It's arguable that Paul initially probably thought he would live long enough to see it, but then towards the end, through his various imprisonments, he realized, I'm probably going to die before this happens. And what's the thought? Whether I live or die. Right? And that's when you get that famous saying in the Bible, in the famous passage. And the thought is, this is not for us to decide now. But I do know that there's hope in what's to come. And the evidence is that God sent his son to die for us, right? And to fulfill his promises. So it's not me having to work hard to make the promises effective. It's not get after it, make it happen. It's not that at all. It's resting and receiving. It's realizing this was done. It's through faith. And I don't know about you, but that's really difficult to do, because it's so much easier for someone to give me a to-do list and then check it off than to just realize that it's been done. And then what does that mean? Figuring out the workings of the resurrection is just as important as getting a clear understanding of what the resurrection is to begin with. And that's where we are now, in the here and now, trying to figure out what is that power. But it's not enough to just believe that Jesus was a good teacher, had some good sayings, and he cared a lot about the poor and the immigrant. These are all great things. And it's not enough to just say he came back from the dead without connecting it to God's plan and purpose. You have to see both at work here in this unique moment in history, of which we know what? It's been fulfilled. And in God's time and plan, we will ultimately be rejoined with a glorified body that no longer tastes this kind of corruption that we have. And we will have fellowship like I can only imagine now. So I don't know if you have any questions, like a minute or two, and then. All right. Yes, John.
Any idea how much time passed between Paul having the conversion and when he started to evangelize or write?
I'm sure John could probably answer that better than me, but I think it's very quickly. It's not the case that he just sits around. And so you have the restoration of the site that happens, and then you get Paul's missionary journeys. This is even when people consider, like, did human beings write the scriptures? Did God just put him in a trance, and he's in a trance writing? It's obviously human agency writing these words down, but it's God inspiring these words, and we believe these are the words of God, right? Not just they imitate God or mirror God, but it's not just they were put into a trance and they took some kind of, you know, elixir or ate some food, and then all, you know, we don't believe that. What we do believe is that these are the words of God given to him, inspired, right? By the authorship inspired. So was it human authorship? Yes. So if that's what you're asking me, were these actually the words of Paul? I'd say yes. Were they words of God? I'd say yes. Both. All right. So thank you for sticking this out. And next week, we're going to focus more on the actual event itself. And eventually, I'm going to show a video, just let you know where we're going. A lot of this has been inspired. I've been inspired a lot by a book that N.T. Wright wrote. And I'm going to show a little thing that he did on a question and answer period about some of these topics, which I think will help as well. All right, but that's weeks to come, Lord willing. All right, so let me just pray, and then thank you for being here. Father, we thank you for this time. We thank you for how you are the Lord of all, including our lives, most importantly, but the life of this church and community. And I pray that we would continue to not conform to our own understanding, but be more and more conformed to the image of your Son, who you sent to die for us, as the first fruits, as the fulfillment. And we eagerly look for that day to come where the new age and the present age will mirror your perfect plan as we know it is already in motion. It's in Jesus' name we pray.